welcome to Tuesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, historian Dr. Tom Ezern challenges the tendency to lump North and South Dakota together as the Dakotas. And federal cuts have left farmers without local conservation experts. We'll have both those stories and more in just a bit, but first we travel to Bowman and meet Lynn James, one of North Dakota's longest-serving community leaders. Bowman sits in the far southwestern corner of North Dakota, where agriculture, energy, and small-town enterprise meet a landscape rich with fossils, frontier history, and wide-open spaces. But what does it take to keep a community like Bowman strong and to persuade a new generation that its future can be built there? Few people have watched that story unfold as closely as Lynn James. She has served as president of the Bowman City Commission since 2004 and has been part of city government even longer. She's also the owner of Flowers and Cappuccino by Lasting Visions, a multi-generational Main Street business that has operated since 1989. Lynn joins us to introduce us to Bowman, not simply as a place on the map, but as a community people call home. Lynn, welcome to Main Street.
Craig, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the ask.
I am really pleased that you are with us today. You were born and raised in Bowman, spent a brief time away, and then returned with your husband, Gordon, to raise your family. What drew you home, and what do you recognize in Bowman that made you want to invest your life there?
You know, when we were a young married couple, it seemed like bigger must be better. And that was kind of the mantra of the parents saying, go away, you know, there isn't much here. And so we left. And it was probably the best decision we ever made because it made us want to come home and made us want to be here and contribute to the community and raise our family here. So for us, bigger wasn't better. And we just really have been happy coming back. My husband also owns a business and has served, you know, the community in different capacities as well. But we just love Bowman, and we're so proud of it. And we taught our kids to be proud of where they come from as well.
You first ran for the Bowman City Commission in 1996, and you served as president of the Bowman City Commission since 2004, which makes you, Lynn, one of North Dakota's longest-serving municipal leaders. So what has sustained your commitment, and how have you kept it responsive after more than, two decades?
I really think being boots on the ground is probably the most important thing. Listening to people, trying to get results for them when they have a concern or an idea, and always being available. You know, when I am at my Main Street business, I'm more accessible than most commissioners that we have had over the years, just because of their jobs or the fact that they were retired or things like that, where people can just walk in and talk to me. And my cell number's out there on our website, and I'm just always accessible.
When you first joined the commission, what did you believe you could contribute way back then? And then how has your understanding of public service changed since then?
Back then, I was young and curious and very happy to be in Bowman. And so my idea was to try to contribute in a manner that would make Bowman always a strong community, always moving forward, that the status quo wasn't enough. And so I always was looking for things to make it better, whether it just be policies or whether it be supporting our local economic development, just whatever options we could bring to the table to make Bowman a spot that people wanted to not only visit, but maybe live here. That's kind of where I was at that point. As I grew in leadership, I've taken many courses and used the North Dakota League of Cities organization as a resource over the years. I've learned so many more aspects of leadership and how important it is to offer a solid foundation for your leadership team. I just can't say enough about the foresight and vision that we've had at the city level, the county level, economic development level. You know, we've just really been fortunate for forward-thinking elected leaders.
Lynn, we're going to have a chance to talk a little bit more about the work that you've accomplished in the commission. But for listeners who've never visited Bowman, take me through an ordinary morning. What would I see? What might we not immediately understand about the community if we're just passing through?
Well, you know, we're at the intersection of two highways, North Dakota Highway 12 and then Federal Highway 85. And we have quite a bit of traffic through here, particularly on Highway 85. You know, we are in between the Bakken and the Black Hills. There's a lot of traffic for tourism. There's a lot of traffic for oil and gas. So you see that. We don't have any stoplights here, but you do have to wait to cross the highway more so than you used to. And now also we have traffic that's headed for the Teddy Roosevelt Library, which is wonderful. And then, you know, you see the retired folks having coffee, and they always are interested in people that stop in, like, for example, at my place. They'll stop and visit with people that are passing through. And we love to meet those people and find out what brings them, either brings them here or brings them through. We have a great Main Street. We have a great museum and library that are public. Agriculture, very strong here. So you see a lot of ag businesses. Of course, they have yard storage, so you notice it. And we just are a very progressive community. We're actually building a new fire hall right now, just outside of town in our business park. And that's very exciting for our community. We have a volunteer fire department that is not supported by a tax levy, which is one, I think we're only one of two in the state.
I'm curious, Lynn, when you mentioned that you were drawn back to Bowman, what was it mm-hmm. then that did that? And let me ask you then, are those same qualities still present in the town today?
Yes, yes. You know, we moved to Denver and we both had great jobs, but you didn't feel like you were in a community. You felt like you were in a city. Nobody really said hello or, you know, acted like they cared if you waved at them or anything. In fact, they might look a little funny at you if you waved at them. You come home here and people are happy to see you. They want to know how you are. They want to know about your family. They support your kids in their activities. They support your elderly, you know, and as they grow old, all the different things that make it community. Our churches are interactive with one another. It's just really good. Our school, too, is fantastic. So I think community is the most important thing.
Do I hear you saying that the remoteness really has shaped Bowman, and that's not really a challenge, but it's a plus?
It is a plus. We're far enough away from the big box stores that, you know, we are able to have a thriving grocery store and different businesses in town, lumber yards and so forth. And we're on those highways, so we get the traffic, the tourism traffic through. And just, in fact, I'm sitting outside while we do this, and I just see three campers, one after the other, headed north. I bet they're going to Medora. You know, just different things. But I don't think it's a hindrance for us. Not always. There are times, you know, when you're trying to recruit a doctor, for example, and the spouse wants to know where the nearest Walmart is, or, you know, that kind of thing.
When that question comes your way, and I'm sure it does often, what do you say?
Mm-hmm. Well, we talk about all the things that are available right here, and usually they're surprised.
You've had a chance to work with your mother, your daughter, your granddaughter. They've all been mm-hmm. involved in your business. So what has working across four generations taught you, Lynn, about not only the continuity of the business, but about Bowman?
Oh, gosh. You know, we just really cherished that time together. My mom has now retired. But it's something I think goes to community again, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a story that you don't often hear. And so for us to be able to say that we have that four-generation core right here, we're just so fortunate, you know. My daughter and her kids and her husband, they're ranchers, but they go to school in Bowman here, and she works in town. But to have them here, and they're too, they moved away and came back because they wanted community and they wanted the ranch life. Our other daughter, on the other hand, lives in Denver, and that's what makes her happy. So it takes a little bit of everything.
Enjoying my conversation with Lynn James. Few people have served as long as she has. She has been on the city commission since 1996 and served as its president since 2004. Lynn, I want to talk a little bit more now about your governing. I've got to believe every now and then you have disagreements, and it is a small community. It is a small town. How do you lead through controversy, Lynn, in a small community without damaging relationships that you guys depend on?
You know, that's difficult to navigate at times, but I'm a firm believer that if you make your decisions based on facts and the greater good, what can we do that is the best for the most people? When we make those decisions, sometimes it affects me or my business adversely, but at the same time, I know that that decision was better for more people than just me. So my decisions are never made for personal gain. Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer that that would be the downfall of leadership. But you just have to navigate through it and talk through it.
What are your biggest challenges right now, Lynn? Is it housing? Is it recruiting community? Is it recruiting people?
All of the above. We have some great workforce programs to help recruit, but it's always a challenge. I think our service industry is probably one of the toughest, just because you don't have the higher paying positions in retail and restaurant and that type of thing. Workforce, housing is also a problem. We do have some projects going on now, some beautiful homes that are being built that are kind of like retirement homes, all one level, that type of thing, but well done and nice sized. It's opening up other homes in town where people are buying those to downsize a bit and then opening up other homes. Our housing is an issue. Another challenge that we have is a budgetary challenge. You know, in the last session, we were capped at 3% by the legislature for our taxing capacity. And we've always worked to keep the taxes as low as possible, but there are times when you do need to, you know, increase your ask of the people. And so that's a challenge that we are all seeing across the state in every taxing entity, whether it's schools or county, city, park and rec. We all are affected by it statewide. But I know that there are legislators working on that for the next session. We also have a couple of big projects going. Right now, we are in the process of a sanitary sewer rehab project. A portion of it was rehabbed in 2018 using what was called surge funding, and it was an oil and gas benefit that was provided to the oil and gas producing cities and counties. And so we did a large portion of our sewer rehab with those funds. And now the second project is underway currently. And once it's completed, we will have our entire sewer system rehabbed, which I don't know if there's another community in North Dakota that can say that at this point. So we're pretty proud of that. The cost of this rehab will be estimated at $3.5 million. And part of that will come from the State Wastewater Infrastructure Grant Program, as well as Bowman County, and then city funds that we have been saving for it. So with those pieces and in place, we'll be able to have a manageable expense for the users for about 10 years. But we're excited about it. And part of it will be finished here in November, and then the balance will be finished next summer. Then we have a water storage tank. Ours are aged out, and so we are replacing, you know, they talk about water towers. Ours is actually underground. And so that's about a $2.5 million project that will be bid here. The bids will be let in September, this month, I guess. And part of the funding for that will come from, the Drinking Water State Revolving Loan Fund, with a certain percentage of it forgiven, and then also a grant from Bowman County. So again, it'll be a manageable contribution from the users, and that will be expected to be completed by December 27. So we got a couple of big projects going on. That brings workers to town, which, sure. You know, then we have our hotels are busy and our restaurants are busy and campgrounds are busy, you know, so they bring some commerce to town with them too.
When I think of economic development in terms of Bowman, when you think about that, what goes through your mind?
We have got the strongest economic development corporation that I have ever known. I've been involved, you know, statewide, but they are very progressive, always looking for grants. They have rehabbed buildings. They have come up with programs for workforce and daycare and interest buy downs and ways to help new businesses bridge gaps. I'm just so proud of the work that they do.
Where are the great opportunities for businesses that, shoot, they want to find a home? What are the opportunities they could find in Bowman?
Well, we have a business park that is shovel ready. So there's power, water, sewer out to this park. And it's got several different areas where you can do like the retail part. You can do a transitional part where you might have some yard storage. There's industrial piece that has rail access that can be built into it. We own the property there. So that was, of course, controversial, but it's a big, big, big asset for us. Right now, there's one building out there, the USDA building, and then now the fire department is actually building out there. It's right along Highway 12. But it's shovel-ready for most any kind of business, and we have tools in place to help with funding resources and business planning and things like that. It's pretty fortunate.
Finish this sentence for me, Lynn, if you could. Bowman's future depends on what?
Oh, Bowman's future depends on continued growth and strong leadership.
Is it hard for you to attract folks to step into leadership positions?
No, it's been better here the last few years. It was kind of slim pickings for a while, but we actually have a great team at the City Commission right now. We have three new members on our five-member board that took office in July, and they just hit the ground running, and I just can't say enough about our team. I think, you know, the Development Corporation has also done some leadership cultivating with classes and different things, so that has helped, I think, pique the interest of people.
When young people graduate from Bowman County High School, what do you hope they understand about what their hometown has been, even if they leave for college or work adventure?
We hope that they realize the opportunities that are here and that there's always a place for them at home.
Lynn, you've advocated for Western North Dakota communities affected by energy development. What do policymakers sometimes fail to understand about the local costs of producing energy for the state and for the country?
You know, I actually am the chairman of the Western Dakota Energy Association this year and next year, and I have done a lot of advocating, and I think we finally made headway in helping the state policymakers understand the impact of oil and gas development to cities and counties. And it took a lot of work and a lot of very well-spoken people putting together presentations for legislature. Now I'm a little concerned, though, because of our term limits at the legislature, which is new to us. The turnover, I feel, is going to be a challenge in the future, trying to keep our gross production tax that we get from oil and gas. And when I say we, I'm talking Western North Dakota entities, taxing entities, but we get that gross production tax in lieu of property tax. So it's vital for us to hold on to that. And with turnover in the legislature, I feel like we're going to have to start over, you know, almost every session. So that's a concern.
Lynn, I've had the opportunity to tour and host on Main Street folks from the Pioneer Trails Regional Museum. It's a fantastic museum. Remarkable fossil record. It's a hidden gem, first of all. But what do folks say about the museum and other things, and what does it reveal about Bowman County?
Well, you know, that museum has been primarily run by volunteers and developed by volunteers. Right now, you know, we do have paid staff, but only because of some resources that we've been able to find for them. But I think it speaks to the dedication of our community to preserve our history and share it. We're very fortunate to have had the passionate people working so diligently to make that quality museum just shine. I'm very proud of it.
Lynn, as we leave our listeners today, give us your best invitation on why folks should consider Bowman.
You know, this is the best place to live, to work, and to play. We have lots of recreation around here. We have great school, great faith community, and job opportunities left and right. So come on down. If you want a tour, I'm always up to give a tour and, you know, point out all our assets and all the reasons why you should come to Bowman.
Lynn, 20 years from now, are you going to be president of the city commission?
I don't know. You know, I love it, and I have run opposed. I've run unopposed, and I think the people are going to tell me when I'm finished. But I can honestly say, when I don't think I'm doing a good job anymore, I will not run. But I do work hard for the people here.
Lynn James is one of the longest serving leaders in local governments in North Dakota today. She's president of the Bowman City Commission and the owner of Flowers and Cappuccino by Lasting Visions, a multi-generational business on Bowman's Main Street. And we've been talking about the people, the pressures, and the possibilities shaping Bowman and the surrounding region in southwestern North Dakota. Lynn, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you for inviting me, Craig. I really do appreciate it. Come see us sometime.
Still ahead on this Tuesday's Main Street, historian Dr. Tom Ezern challenges the tendency to lump North and South Dakota together, and federal cuts leaves farmers without local conservation experts. That's still to come on today's Main Street, right after this news. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. North and South Dakota may share a name and a border, but historian Tom Ezern says that their histories should not be lumped together. In this week's Plains Folk, he makes the case for North Dakota's distinctive and especially interesting past.
Not a native of the Flickertail State, nevertheless, in the course of decades, I have acquired a complex of defensive sensitivities about it. Phrases like flyover country and Buffalo Commons stirred little hairs on the back of my neck. I like to think this is because they are examples of sloppy thinking, and not because I'm touchy. But self-delusion is a known part of the complex I'm describing. Some of these sensitivities manifest themselves in my life as a writer and editor, such as the use of the phrase, the locals, as in, I arrived in Wishick and found the locals sitting around the McTwist drinking milkshakes, as in their furniture, or at best, rustics, providing local color. Whenever I'm making stylistic decisions, the people are not locals, they are citizens. Then there is that lumping phrase, the Dakotas, as if to say, the authorities got it wrong in 1889. It's really not two sovereign states. It's just a lumpy space on the map. Well, states matter. Our country is a federal democratic republic with 50 capitals, distinct sovereignties, and within them distinct histories, perhaps even cultures. And given my area code, I'm willing to argue that, historically, North Dakota is way more interesting than South Dakota. Let me count the ways. First, the phenomenon of bonanza farming, the creation of James B. Power, land commissioner for the Northern Pacific Railway. I've spent considerable time poring over his letterpress books held by the Institute for Regional Studies at NDSU. He was a complex figure who midwifed corporate agriculture on the prairies, suffered a sort of personal breakdown, and returned as a lifelong advocate of diversified family farming. Ever since, both land use and discourse about agriculture in North Dakota have hinged on these initial conditions. Second, the fur trade and Métis elements in our history. My research in the papers of territorial governors housed at the South Dakota State Archives shows the presence of Métis people in the northern part of the territory was a divisive political issue. Probably we should thank them more often for their formative influence in the creation of our state. Third, the Dakota War of the 1860s, which was not, however you may hear the story out of Minnesota, merely the long tale of their conflict. The war in the northern part of Dakota Territory generated the largest armies and largest military engagements ever to take place on the Great Plains of North America. They were larger than anything in Montana, and indeed, what happened in Montana in the 1870s is not comprehensible without knowledge of what happened in Dakota in the 1860s. Fourth, the Nonpartisan League. The outstanding example of state socialism in American history, with fascinating origins and consequences I cannot begin to detail here. And fifth, the potent emergence of energy development in North Dakota, which is relatively minimal in South Dakota. I'm talking both about Iverson No. 1 in 1951 and everything downstream from that, but also the lignite mining and cooperative power generation emergence that commenced in the next decade. I recall vividly my conversations with Bill Guy about the assertive decisions which made that latter thing happen. I could go on, but I am stopped not only by the limitations of time, but also that bogus Chinese proverb, "May you live in interesting times." Interesting histories can be hard to live through or with.
Dr. Tom Easern is a historian and distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. This essay that he wrote and presented, and others, can be found at our website, prairiepublic.org.
The Fargo Moorhead Quilters announces the 2026 Metro Quilt Expo, September 25th and 26th at Veterans Memorial Arena in West Fargo. More than 200 quilts are expected to be on display, along with quilting demonstrations and vendor exhibits. Information is available at fmquilters.org.
Main Street continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Federal conservation specialists have long helped farmers protect their soil and water while navigating complex grant programs. But after major staffing cuts, many farmers are traveling farther and waiting longer for that expertise. Abigail Botar reports from Harvest Public Media.
Farmers across the country are losing access to federal workers that help them with soil and water conservation efforts. The Natural Resources Conservation Service has been hit hard by the Trump administration's cuts to the federal workforce. Harvest Public Media's Abigail Botar reports on how that's impacting farmers.
On a hot summer day, John Williams is walking me through the vegetable farm he manages in central Illinois.
So all these white tubes coming up are tree tubes, so they're little protections for newly planted trees.
And the farm has a lot of new trees. Hazelnut, apple, and pear trees run in between the fields and around the farm's perimeter. The farm got funding to plant these trees through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, a federal agency under the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Williams says the trees will help protect the farm's soil from strong winds and heavy rains.
That'll help keep more of our soil on our land and less from running downhill.
NRCS staff in county offices across the nation help farmers like Williams implement practices that prevent soil erosion and improve soil health. The agency was founded almost a century ago in response to the Dust Bowl, but it lost nearly a quarter of its staff nationwide last year after President Donald Trump's sweeping cuts to the federal workforce. Adam Grebe grows corn and soy on his farm in central Minnesota. He was recently working on a project to prevent soil erosion, but then the NRCS staffer he was working with left the agency.
Well, I've ended up working with Stearns County, which isn't even an adjacent county office, and then also Carver County. And so I've gotten pushed to other offices.
Grebe says he was sometimes stuck driving an hour to a different county office where he felt like he was starting from square one with new NRCS workers.
You kind of get pushed back to the bottom of the pile when you lose your technician or engineer.
Just across the state line, Wisconsin saw some of the steepest cuts to NRCS staff in the Midwest, losing more than 30% of its workforce. Chuck Anderes is the policy director at Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, a Wisconsin nonprofit focused on sustainable agriculture. He says some highly agricultural counties are now without any NRCS staff at all.
A lot of beginning farmers and a lot of people that are transitioning to grazing for the first time really rely on the technical assistance that they get alongside the cost share money.
It's been feast or famine at the NRCS in recent years. The Biden administration poured more than $19 billion in additional funding for NRCS programs to address climate change. But those funds were rescinded by the Trump administration last year.
You have this demand, you have this proven benefit for farmers, and yet they're taking money away from it.
That's Michael Happ with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, a Minnesota-based nonprofit. He recently analyzed how these cuts are impacting the agency's flagship program. The Environmental Quality Incentives Program had a 38% decrease in grants awarded from 2024 to 2025. Happ says a growing number of farmers are competing for this dwindling funding.
It seems like conservation as an idea keeps getting more and more popular among farmers. We saw an increase in folks lining up out the door to apply for these programs at the same time that the number accepted went down.
Harvest Public Media reached out to the USDA for comment, but officials did not respond. Minnesota farmer Adam Grebe says his recent experience with NRCS won't stop him from applying for future projects, but he can see why other farmers would be more hesitant.
You know, we can only spend so much time doing some of these stewardship projects, and so if you don't have that good help from your offices, you really lose the passion to do the work.
And Grebe worries these cuts will damage conservation efforts for years to come. I'm Abigail Botar, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms covering agriculture and food systems. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Jill Freitas. Too many Indigenous families lack electricity in their homes, but on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, a new project is bringing solar power to tribal homes. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman rode along with the crew to check out three homes at different points in the installation process.
And this is the one that's applied for the solar here, this tiny house?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Hallie Aragon lives in a repurposed shed with her four-year-old and her boyfriend in the backyard of his family's home in Fort Washakie. Right now, their houses are connected by a thick power cord, running electricity from the main house to the tiny one. But she's excited about someday.
Just being able to like turn on a light and not have to worry about the power cords.
Aragon works at Eastern Shoshone Child Support down the road. She looked into getting connected to the electrical pole that powers the main house, but says just getting hooked up was going to cost $2,400.
Because then it would go off of the whole electricity for the whole house, and I imagine the bill would be up there.
So she applied to the Energize Wind River program, which installs solar panels, a battery, and a backup generator. Foreman Austin Hill is stopping by to check out Aragon's tiny house.
We're just going to take measurements and stuff and kind of take pictures of your home and kind of look in.
Because it gets electricity from that umbilical cord connection to the main house, Aragon's home is a good fit for the program. Hill peeks inside to see what the solar might be able to help power.
A lot of the heat kind of rises in here, and so getting a fan in here would be perfect to kind of push that back down. And
the Energize Wind River crew is mostly made up of folks from the reservation, and the bulk of its funding comes from a Bureau of Indian Affairs grant. So far, they've got three systems totally up and running, with more in the works, like Aragon's tiny house.
See you later!
And with that, Hill and the crew are off to another stop, the Headley house. They live off-grid.
Good morning, Reno.
They've got chickens, donkeys, dogs, and a sassy pig named Jack. Their system is almost complete. All that's left is a few final touches. Jesse Dorothy is in the Headley's kitchen, tinkering with some electrical wires.
I'm a master electrician, born and raised on the Wind River Indian Reservation. I've been at it for over 50 years.
Dorothy's working with some of the young guys on the Energize Wind River crew, who are learning the ropes of the trade.
Just going through and checking everything out and checking the light switches, and everything's working really great.
Dorothy says he hopes the solar program can keep expanding, even as a supplement to those who are on the grid.
If this gets going really great, I'd love to see them on every, you know, the elders or the seniors' homes to give them a reduced rate.
Reno Headley says the new system is a godsend and that it's going to be nice to just flip a switch.
There's light.
Down the road and through a few turns is Elder Tommy LeBeau's place. His solar is fully set up, hooked into a new trailer that he's renovating and moving into. His old trailer has a wood stove and a gas generator.
I lived, you know, for well over 25 years without electricity, running water, sewers, and stuff like that. I lived the old way, live off the land, you know, best I can in today's modern times.
LeBeau spent a lot of time in the Wind River Mountains. He's a big hunter. Decades ago, he got into a disagreement with a local power company after he was late on paying a bill.
I was gone for 3 months on the Sundance Highway, we call it the Powwow Highway. But anyway, they shut my electricity off for $11.
That didn't bode well for all the meat that was in LeBeau's freezer.
For $11, I'm like, wow, you guys, you spoiled all my food in my refrigerator and my freezer on my wild game.
So LeBeau was wary of utility companies for a long time. But Hill knew LeBeau and told him about what Energize Wind River was up to. And LeBeau got more interested.
I don't have to worry about running to town or to a gas station to get some gas for my generator. So I got to charge my cell phone up myself because people forgot how to read smoke signals.
LeBeau's big dream is to get the solar system plugged into a freezer so he can keep hunting and living off the land. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Carbon majors are wringing out the West to dry. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
A new study has determined that much of the water crisis in the American West can be squarely laid at the feet of fossil fuel companies.
Researchers from the Union of Concerned Scientists and the University of California Merced found that emissions linked to oil, gas, coal, and cement producers, the so-called carbon majors, which include companies like BP, Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Shell, have disrupted the water cycle, draining precious supplies from an already water-strained region.
Through their business activities, those companies have accounted for nearly 70% of global industrial carbon dioxide emissions since 1854, with 97% of those emissions occurring after 1950.
Since 1950, the researchers say human-caused climate change has reduced snowpack and streamflow and driven up agricultural demand.
The authors found that between 2014 and 2024, Emissions from just 122 of the carbon majors accounted for roughly half of the climate impacts, wringing more than 28 million acre-feet of water from the West, an amount that could fill Lake Mead to capacity.
CO2 pollution has created seasonal mismatches between supply and demand. In many Western river basins, the authors say the midpoint of annual stream flow now happens roughly 6 days earlier than it would have without the emissions.
In some mountainous regions, that shift can be up to 30 days earlier, making it challenging for agriculture and driving up groundwater loss. However, the effects of changing water supply and increasing demand extend far beyond agriculture, creating a cascade of impacts, including increased wildfires and degraded ecosystems.
Since 1959, some of the fossil fuel companies knew of the climate risks their products posed, but engaged in coordinated disinformation campaigns to deny the science and protect their profits.
Given their outsized contributions of carbon to the atmosphere and their decades-long deception, the researchers say that the companies should face accountability for their climate harms.
As opposition to data centers grows across the U.S., there's news about how they affect water supplies and air quality.
First, a study from Ceres, a nonprofit advocacy group for clean energy, warns that these facilities are threats to water supplies because of the quantities they require to provide them electricity.
They found that in the 7 states with the highest concentration of data centers, 3.5 trillion gallons of fresh water are required to provide their energy every year.
That amount, according to the report, is the equivalent of 12 times the annual water usage of Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Washington, D.C. combined.
To date, the quantity of water consumed by data centers for cooling servers has received the most attention. However, this study highlights the amount needed to produce the electricity to keep them running.
Beyond high water use, data centers can also emit harmful air pollution, like carbon monoxide, heavy metals, and nitrogen oxide, the last of which contributes to ozone.
Some data centers use natural gas turbines and diesel engines to generate power, which can take reliance off the grid, but also spew toxic emissions into local communities.
In the past, the public has been notified and given the opportunity to comment before a company can get a permit from the EPA to emit the pollutants.
Now, the Trump administration is planning to ditch the rule that requires public notice, keeping the process in the dark.
That process has been required for about 50 years and covers many types of facilities, from landfills to paper mills, power plant expansions, and now, more recently, data centers. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Environmental Protection Agency under Trump is focused on expanding all the things it cannot do for the people of the United States.
And finally, want to know if your garden soil is healthy? A new study says, use your underwear.
Researchers from the University of Zurich enlisted 1,000 volunteers across Switzerland to bury more than 2,000 pairs of cotton underwear, then dig them up 2 months later and send them along with surrounding soil to the laboratory.
So what did the buried brief show, some of which were barely there? One significant conclusion was that the way land is used is the most important factor in determining soil health.
Depending on location, undies decomposed at different rates. The more biologically active soil organisms, the faster the cotton was broken down.
The underwear decomposed the fastest in residential gardens where there were ideal conditions for earthworms, fungi, and bacteria, but degraded the slowest in lawns.
The research showed that soil management significantly affects its quality and that pesticides and mineral fertilizers can degrade it. Additionally, they said diversifying crop rotations and keeping soil covered are important.
Bottom line, soiling your underwear can be an easy way to get the dirt on your garden.
Get the dirt on water and climate news by signing up for our newsletter at h2oradio.org. That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Mm-hmm. This is Dakota Datebook for September 1st. The earliest telephones were very basic. One telephone couldn't call another phone directly unless the two phones were connected. The caller needed an intermediary. Phone users called an exchange instead of the person or business they wanted to reach. Telephone operators connected them. On this date in 1878, Emma Nutt became the first woman to work as a telephone operator. She started a trend, and it wasn't long before virtually all telephone operators were women who worked out of their own homes. The first telephone to arrive in North Dakota was installed by J. L. Grandin. He saw them at the 1876 Philadelphia Centennial Exposition and bought two of them to install at his Bonanza Farm. The battery-operated devices were used to facilitate communication between the main farm and one of the divisional farms. The first telephones came with a price tag of $100, which would be about $2,500 today, although the price did include installation. While the telephone was considered a luxury by the general public, the advantages for businesses were apparent from the beginning, and North Dakota gradually got connected. The Fargo-Moorhead Telephone Exchange was incorporated in 1880 and began operation the following year with 25 connections, all of them businesses. Bella Thompson, age 15, was hired as the first telephone operator in North Dakota. The exchange hired a female because boy operators often indulged in practical jokes and many times talked back to customers. Most people today don't know what a party line was. Now for me, growing up on a farm in Mountrail County in northwestern North Dakota, I do remember what a party line was. Several users shared the same line. The downside was that if one person was making a phone call, none of the other users could make a call until that person hung up. The advantage was that it was cheaper. In 1881, telephone rates were $4.98 per month for a private line, and $4.10 for a two-party line, and $3.51 per month for a four-party line. The telephone significantly improved communication in North Dakota. Businesses could function more efficiently. It also connected people and was especially important in rural areas. It alleviated rural isolation and allowed people to call for help if needed. Today, we carry our phones in our pockets, but in 1880, it was a big deal to have one in the home. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Rick Gion, Major Gifts Manager here at Prairie Public. When you give to Prairie Public, you hear your donation at work. Your generosity helps everyone in the Prairie region have access to programs that educate, involve, and inspire. If you'd like to pay Prairie Public forward in an even more impactful way, I invite you to join our Investor Circle. It's a group of members who care deeply about Prairie Public and who want quality, non-commercial programming and fact-driven news to touch even more people in our communities. Become an Investor Circle member right now with a gift of $1,200 or more annually or at $100 per month. Go to prairiepublic.org/support for more details. And thank you for caring about Prairie Public.
The mayor of Kyiv says Ukraine does not have enough weapons to fight against Russia's nonstop bombardment.
The main goal of Putin to rebuild the Russian Empire. And if we will be not successful, Putin definitely never stop.
The View from a Capital Under Siege. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this in all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to Main Street as one of your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, Lynn James. She's the president of the Bowman City Commission and owner of Flowers and Cappuccino by Lasting Visions. It's a multi-generational business on Bowman's Main Street. And she'll introduce us to this southwestern North Dakota community and discuss its people, economy, and determination to thrive. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.